Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, from my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention? I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
So, guys, have you ever watched a little-known documentary film called Jurassic Park?
I only saw Jurassic Park 3, but it was fantastic. No, I saw Jurassic Park in the theater when I was a kid, and it blew my mind. I got the VHS tape when it came out, and I watched it until the tape was no more.
Right. I mean, it was certainly one of those that sparked people's imaginations. For one thing, of course, it was a great example of CGI in an era when, before that, you didn't really see it at that level of sophistication. It was, for the time, really believable effects.
Oh, yeah. People love CGI in the 90s, but if you go back and watch most of those 90s movies now, they look awful.
Yeah, they definitely don't measure up.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, Jurassic Park was one of the ones that really incorporated puppets and also practical and CG, which
that was a good choice.
How things held up.
Yep. And so here's the thing, guys. You know, it kind of popularized this idea of what if we could get some sort of genetic material from long extinct species and then through some sort of science application, bring those extinct species back to life, a la Jurassic Park.
You notice in Jurassic Park, when they're taking them through the lab, they kind of skip through all the hard parts.
Well, I love that the science is all delivered by a cartoon character that is dumbing everything down for the lowest common denominator. And part of that is so that the writers don't have to go to the trouble of actually explaining how it works.
Or how it would work if it could work.
Right.
Well, the book, to be fair, went a little bit more into that, but it's still absolutely a work of fiction. And even though Michael Crichton has this cute tendency of footnoting his fictional works, that doesn't mean that those footnotes are based on.
Whoa. Work of fiction? Now, I thought we had already cloned a few dinosaurs. Is that not true?
No.
We don't have resurrected raptors and T-Rexes.
We do not.
Somewhere in Texas?
No. Only in my heart.
Yeah, sadly no. So the reason why this is a part of our discussion today is because in the news recently, there have been some articles about de-extinction. And we wanted to talk about what de-extinction is and what its applications could be and why there is controversy around it. But to start off, kind of helps lay the groundwork if we actually talk about just the whole problem of extinction in the first place. So first, how many species go extinct every year?
I don't know how you could even guess.
Yeah.
I
mean, it turns out that's very difficult. You can really just estimate. For one thing, we don't even know how many species there are, do we?
Absolutely not. We are still discovering some like 15,000 species every year. And, researchers think that of the 1.2 million that we've already documented on this, our wonderful planet Earth, that might be a part of some 8.7 million that are kicking around.
Wow. So, yeah, we still have quite a bit of quite a few more species to discover before we get close to it.
We're like not even a quarter of the way there.
There might be some 80% of life on Earth that is yet undiscovered. But here's the thing. A lot of the ones that we're currently discovering are already endangered.
Yeah. So they're already, you know, the population's already so small that the smallest of influences could make these populations go extinct.
Things could be going extinct before we have even documented them.
And it's worth pointing out that things go extinct naturally. I mean, that happens all the time.
Oh, sure. Not just when meteors hit either.
Right. No, I mean, just due to the pressures of nature, you know, food supply and predation, things go out of business. Sometimes a species is gone. But also, we drive things to extinction, don't we?
Yes, there's natural background extinction, which is what the rate of extinction would be if humans were not part of the picture. And it is significantly lower than once you factor humans in.
How significantly?
Well, scientists estimate that the extinction rate is 1,000 to 10,000 times greater than that background extinction rate, according to the World Wildlife Fund. So that's 1,000 to 10,000 times. I mean, that's human influence right there. On top of that, that means that anywhere between 0.01 and 0.1% of all species go extinct every year. And again, the reason why 0.01 to 0.1 is because we don't know how many species there are, nor can we really get an estimate on exactly how many are going extinct every year. So these are all, you know, based on like wide ranges of guesses. And if you want to know how wide, well, the estimation of how many species are out there, and the extinction rates taken into, as a combination mean that something between 200 and 100,000 species are going extinct every year. So on the low end, 200 species, not great, but you know, not 100,000. But again, all of this is just based on those crazy estimations of how many species are out there and how many are actually dying out.
Right. And I do want to put in that not all of these species are like adorable monkeys. There's a lot of bacteria and stuff like that involved in these calculations.
Right, right.
And some of them, however, are totally adorable monkeys.
Some of them are adorable monkeys or some other, you know, equally adorable animal. And according to the IUCN Red List criteria, there are 16,938 species on the endangered list. And the same list identifies 905 species that are now extinct in the wild.
Now extinct, like, since the beginning of this classification?
Yeah, essentially they're identifying species. Some of these, there are still examples of those species, but they are all in captivity.
Oh, okay.
None of them are in the wild.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Like in zoos or labs.
Exactly.
Or...
You won't find them in their home ecosystems anymore. At least none have been spotted for at least a few decades. And in fact, that's one of the problems with listing animals as extinct. You know, it's all based upon our observations. It's not like we have a little light on a giant switchboard, and when the light goes out, you know that that species is gone. So it's a little complicated.
Okay, so now that we can see how fast the problem is getting worse, that we're changing ecosystems constantly by knocking species out of business, this can't be a great idea to just drive species to extinction with no forethought. Is it possible to reverse the polarity?
Okay, so we're going Star Trek on this. technically, it depends. It depends upon the species and how long it's been extinct. So, for example, Jurassic Park. That's the example with all the dinosaurs coming back. Is that realistic? As it turns out, it is not. And the reason for that is because DNA degrades over time. It does not remain completely pristine. Even if you were to find a mosquito buried in amber that had dinosaur blood in it, that DNA will degrade within the little gut of that mosquito. So it's not like you're going to suddenly have a perfect strand of DNA where you can sequence a dinosaur's genome. It's just not going to happen.
Well, you're not even going to get like a few little strands like... I don't know. Give me some numbers here.
Okay.
The thing is that DNA is only really readable for about a million years. It's got a half-life of 521 years, which means that half of the nucleotide bonds in it will break down every 521 years, right?
Gotcha.
Which means that basically anything over a million years old is effectively gibberish, and anything over some 6.8 million is effectively destroyed, which is pretty impressive for DNA. That's a lot longer than we actually thought originally that it was going to last. But the thing is that the dinosaur extinction event happened some 63 million years ago. The oldest sample of DNA I've read about being used to create a successful clone was only frozen for 16 years.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. So, but here's a question I always had about Jurassic Park, which is, even if you could get that DNA, even if what you're talking about didn't happen, how would you make it into an egg that hatches?
Yeah, we'd have to...
I feel like they skipped over that part in the movie. I don't remember what they said. Something about frogs.
Well, they filled in gaps in the genome that they had. And we'll talk a little bit about filling in gaps, because that actually something that people are trying to do.
Yeah, no, they filled it with the DNA of a frog. I guess the question is more like physical. How'd they get it into an egg?
They also used frog eggs, I believe, for cloning purposes. The way that cloning works is usually you scoop the DNA out of a existing cell nucleus and put new DNA material in there, right?
Right, and then you hope it ends up forming an embryo.
Yeah, the problem is that egg cells contain mitochondria, which contain their own little bits of DNA from the donor animal. And unlike in, say, Star Trek, when Klingons and humans, which evolved on completely separate planets, can produce viable offspring, or even in Jurassic Park, where it just gave them plot-dependent, hero-saving weaknesses, really, it's more likely that these cells would just be unviable. They would not be able to germinate, would not produce any kind of life.
Yeah. And also, I should point out that it wasn't just weaknesses. It also gave them their strength, because that was what gave the dinosaurs the ability to spontaneously switch sexes.
Oh,
so that allowed
right.
them to continue
yeah.
to have, because they were supposed to all be female. And then a couple of them ended up being able, because the genetic material they had was taken from frogs that were able to change their genders based
because
upon their population.
Because life finds a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess we can't bring dinosaurs back.
Right.
What can we do? Maybe we can't resurrect a T-Rex. Can we resurrect something like a mammoth?
Actually, there are a lot of people working on exactly that. The woolly mammoth has become kind of the poster animal for a lot of different efforts. Not the only one. We've got another one we'll chat about.
Yeah, populations of woolly mammoths were around as early, late as about 10,000 years ago, or possibly as recently as 4,000 years ago.
Yeah, so that's certainly a viable option. Most of the time I hear around 10,000 years is about what people expect to be able to bring back from extinction. That's like a kind of a round figure that people throw around. But as for actual efforts, like real scientists doing real science trying to bring extinct animals back, we've got two examples we can talk about right now that were semi-successful. Semi-successful meaning that ultimately you didn't have an animal survive very long, but
yes.
but there was
kind
promising
of sad,
development. Yeah.
But technically successful.
So if you get sad about stories about furry animals not living very long, you may want to skip ahead a little bit, because I'm going to tell you about Celia.
Lay it on me.
All right. So Celia was the last known living bracado, which is a type of ibex. And for those of us who don't encounter ibex is very frequently, that's sort of kind of like a goat-like animal. It's the ones that have the really long rounded horns and like they loop back. Well, the bracado was one population, one species. So it had dwindled until they really only thought there was this one living bracado left, and they named her Celia. Fitted her with a collar, kept her in the wild. The collar monitored Celia's life signs. And then one day the collar essentially indicated that Celia's heart had stopped beating. A team went out to find out what had happened and discovered that Celia had been crushed to death by the limb of a falling tree. They managed to harvest some cells from Celia, and they froze them. They preserved them. And then years later, another team of researchers and scientists decided to try and bring the bracado back.
It was only about 3 years later, so the cells had not been in cold storage for very long.
Yeah, they ended up harvesting the nuclei from those cells, and then they used emptied goat egg cells and injected the nuclei from the bracado into the goat egg cells, and then implanted those into surrogate mothers. And they did 57 attempts. Only 7 of those resulted in pregnancy, and 6 of those ended in miscarriage. However, that last example was actually brought all the way up to where you had a baby bracado delivered by C-section. The baby bracado, or the kid, unfortunately, didn't have its lungs developed properly. One of its lungs actually formed essentially like a solid mass of tissue, kind of like they described it being more like a liver than a lung.
Yeah, that's not good for breathing.
Yeah, and it essentially suffocated to death shortly after it was born. So it only survived a couple of minutes. So that's very sad, but it did lay the groundwork and foundation for a lot of other groups to kind of make this attempt. This was back in 2003. So this was, you know, more than a decade ago now. There's another project called the Lazarus Project, which it's the University of Newcastle, Australia, and they decided to go with a totally different kind of cute, cuddly animal, a frog that gives birth by regurgitating its babies. Yeah, it's a frog that gives birth through its mouth. It essentially regurgitates its babies.
But if you kiss it, it regurgitates a prince.
It actually regurgitates Prince, and he'll sing Purple Rain.
It turns into a prince that regurgitates frogs.
I think we might be getting off track. What actually happens is the way this frog reproduces, it lays eggs, the eggs are fertilized, and then the frog swallows the eggs to protect them. And then once the eggs hatch, it pukes up the babies. So this particular frog, though, had gone extinct. Joe, this is no laughing matter. This is life.
I'm just protecting them.
Well, sure. When you put it like that, it sounds like it's, you know, obscene. But no, it's really how these animals survive. And this particular animal, that the Rheobatrachius silus frog, went extinct back in the 1970s. But some of its cells had been in deep freeze, in a regular freezer, actually, since the 1970s. And so the Lazarus Project harvested the nuclei, and then they put them into emptied frog cells from great barred frogs, which are a fairly close relative to the frog that had gone extinct. So some of the cells began to divide and go right into the embryo stage, but none of the embryos survived past a few days. So again, sort of promising results, but not a full success. Then you have another group called Revive and Restore. This is one that I thought was really interesting. There are several articles that published in early 2014 about their particular drive to de-extinction technologies. And their approach is a little different from what we've been talking about. They're looking at creating a chimera, which is not the mythological creature that, you know, you may be familiar with, particularly if you played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons as a kid.
Although that would be cool. Can we de-extinctify mythical animals as well?
Gelatinous cube.
Well, we gotta wait till the end of the podcast before we talk about that.
Okay.
But we will address that, yes. But yes, Revive and Restore was looking at creating these animals that outwardly resemble one species, but internally have some elements of a different species. So they are a chimera of two different species. And the example that was used in all the articles, because one of the people involved in Revive and Restore is so passionate about this particular species, is the passenger pigeon. Now, I don't know how much you guys know about passenger pigeons. At one time, it was the dominant species of birds in the United States. There were something like 5 billion of them.
I've read reports of, like, the flocks of them blotting out the sun.
Yeah, they made up 60% of all birds in the U.S. So to think that we went from a population that enormous to completely extinct in just a couple of decades due to hunting and other problems as well is pretty eye-opening. To think that, you know, essentially that's saying, like, no species is safe. If you think of something that looks that plentiful and yet could go extinct that quickly, it's a real eye-opener. Well, the idea behind the passenger pigeon approach is to sequence the passenger pigeon genome by harvesting cells from various museum exhibits that have passenger pigeons, like, you know, stuffed on display, to take some cells from that and to try and sequence the genome. And there's gaps in that genome, kind of like in Jurassic Park. And so to fill in those gaps, they start looking at some of the closest relatives to the passenger pigeon and trying to kind of, you know, fudge it a little bit, fill it in.
Yeah, the modern band-tailed pigeon, I think, is really close.
One of the closest. And the idea is to get to a point where they can sequence DNA so that they can inject it directly into an egg of a band-tailed pigeon. They'd actually make a little hole in the egg, inject the DNA down into it, and then patch the hole with essentially what looks like Saran wrap, and allow it to continue to develop until it hatches into a hatchling. Now, the hatchling is going to look and behave just like a band-tailed pigeon. It is, to all outward appearances, a simple band-tailed pigeon. But its reproductive cells, as in its egg or sperm cells, will be passenger pigeon cells. So if you can take a male and female band-tailed pigeon that's been altered in this way and breed them together, then in theory, you would get a passenger pigeon. Kind of cool. Also weird.
A little bit terrifying, yeah. But pretty cool, yeah.
The weirdest part is, or I don't know if it's the weirdest part, but a weird part is that they're not really sure how to teach the passenger pigeons how to be passenger pigeons, assuming that this works. Because this is not something that's happened yet. It's something that they hypothesize would be possible, but they haven't proved it yet. But the thing that they're wondering is, okay, if it hatches into this passenger pigeon, after, you know, it's two generations removed from when things
from
got
the creation,
started.
Yeah.
Will it behave like a band-tailed pigeon, or would some behaviors be innate in passenger pigeons?
That would come down to the question of whether its behaviors are more learned or instinctual.
Yeah.
Sure. And I'm wondering, in the case of pigeons, I mean, and no offense to pigeon aficionados out there, but exactly how big the difference is, and whether or not that's whether or not that's the operative point when you're talking pigeons.
I think the biggest difference is migratory patterns, because the passenger pigeon didn't migrate very much. And some of these other pigeons do. So it's one of those things where they're not sure if this is even possible. And if we do bring passenger pigeons back, will they behave the way passenger pigeons of old did? Or will they be some sort of new species that are very close to what passenger pigeons were, but behave in a different way? And honestly, people aren't sure. And those are important questions, because that also puts an impact upon the ecosystem that the passenger pigeon encounters. Like, you have to remember, and we're going to talk about this a lot in our next section, about the fact that the world is this really interconnected, complicated system. And just because you add one thing in one place doesn't mean it's not somehow going to affect something else really far away, just through this whole, you know, kind of domino effect or chaos theory, if you're a certain mathematician. So this brings us to this question of, if, let's assuming that these different approaches bear fruit, that they are able to bring at least some types of extinct species back to life through one of these methods, what are some of the other ethical and practical considerations we have to make with this technology in mind?
One of the ones I've seen, though I take some issue with it, is this view that, well, it might be a zero-sum game, you know,
right?
So that if we're putting money and effort and time and attention into bringing extinct species back from the dead, are we going to be therefore losing all of those same types of investments that we should be putting into keeping endangered species alive?
Well, yeah. I mean, if it's this super flashy, sexy kind of technology where you could tell people, hey, the majestic woolly mammoth could stride across the plains again. I mean, people are going to get excited about that. But it's something that none of us have ever seen.
Who cares about pandas? Let's bring the woolly mammoth
to
back.
To be fair, even conservationists say, who cares about pandas? Because they claim, or at least the ones I read claim, are the panda thing is, like, pandas are plentiful compared to, say, white rhinos. You know?
Well, who cares about white rhinos? Let's bring woolly mammoths
back. See, that's the worry, right? And like you said, it's kind of two-pronged. It's worrying about taking attention away from conservation efforts, and also, and probably more importantly, money from conservation efforts.
Yeah, so if that were really how it worked, like, in order to invest in bringing something back from extinction, you have to take money away from conservation, I would consider that a very legitimate complaint. I don't think it necessarily works that way.
Like, no, and I think that really, in fact, you're going to be drawing attention to the overall issue. And I mean, I would imagine.
Well, I know that a lot of these projects specifically take conservation as one of their big concerns, so that they acknowledge that conservation is very important, and that they don't want to be considered an alternative to conservation, that's more of a supplement to conservation efforts. But
like,
the way,
specifically saying it's not a zero sum game.
Right. The problem is that when you start reporting on this stuff, and I mean, it's easy to see why this happens in the media, but the attention is, this is super awesome, cool technology that could really be interesting if it works. And it would be able to bring species that most of us have never, ever seen back to life. That's really enticing. And it may not be the real story may not be that it's, you know, de-extinction versus conservation. It's just that the way the media portrays it, it seems like de-extinction is the cool thing and conservation isn't really mentioned very frequently, except in some of those more in-depth articles where they really try to dig down deep and get into the story. And we read quite a few of those articles, and some of them are amazing. Like, they really look at all facets of the story, and they take this head on. And I would agree that I think conservation and de-extinction can survive side by side. They can complement one another. I do also think that when it comes to someone giving their money to a cause, the de-extinction one might seem more attractive to certain people just because it does seem more exotic and flashy. But I don't think it's going to be something that funnels like 90% of the funding away from conservation.
Yeah, and I don't think that anyone's going to just say, like, well, screw those pandas because we can just revive them later.
Yeah.
If I mean,
yeah, it seems like some people do take that complaint. Let me, if I can advocate something here, despite the fact that this is a future technology kind of show we're doing here, if you are really actually forced to choose between conservation and de-extinction, go with conservation, obviously.
Right.
Oh, sure.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit about how some of these approaches can help in conservation efforts as well. And I should also point out that everyone says, and not that I have a money figure to put on this, but everyone says that this de-extinction approach is going to be complicated. It's going to be, especially in the early years, unreliable or difficult, and it's going to be really expensive. So it's not something that is going to be done for every single species that has ever gone extinct. There's going to be choices made, and so it may very well be that this is something that happens with a few passion projects where people are really pushing to bring back certain species and others are left behind. And it's not because one is better than the other. It's just that that's where people were able to direct the money and effort toward.
Sure. But let's talk about a few of those reasons why we would want to. I mean, if we really only had $10 and those $10 could fund either de-extinction forever or conservation forever, why should we go with conservation?
I'd say one thing is that it's something you can trust in because you can see it. Like, it's our conservation actually works.
Yeah.
Like, there's no question about, you know, what will happen if we stop killing these animals?
Right.
You know, like, oh, okay, if we stop killing them, that actually will work. De-extinction is questionable. It might work. It might not.
Sure. So there's a risk on return. I mean, just based upon that, if you want to just separate yourself from the whole animal thing, there's one method that you know is going toward helping actual living creatures right now, and one method that could possibly maybe bring something back,
yeah,
but we aren't sure.
We also know that any animal that is sustaining a population on Earth today, at least barring major human intervention, has a place in its current ecosystem.
Right. In other words, the ecosystem is able to support that population.
I would say, well, maybe let's bring back the woolly mammoth. Well, I'm not sure that the woolly mammoth necessarily has a place in today's ecosystem.
And that is another great argument that people make about this de-extinction question. It's that you can't really be sure with some of these species that they would have a place in the world where they could survive, let alone thrive. And for species that have been extinct for a few thousand years, the question is more, you know, unknown. We don't know, because ecosystems do change over time, not necessarily rapidly, unless there's outside intervention in the form of, you know, humans messing with an ecosystem or something really massive like a meteor strike or whatever, meteorite, I guess I should say, strike. But these systems do change over time, and it's possible that some species would find it very difficult to survive in today's ecosystems.
Absolutely, and we're not just talking about the macro scale of predators and prey and all that kind of stuff. Also the micro scale. I mean, the more that we learn about the microbiome, the more we think it could have a serious impact on any given macro organism's quality of life and even survival. We talked recently in our episodes about antibiotics and hygiene, that germs aren't always harmful. You know, a lot of them evolved in tandem with multicellular species, and that really weird stuff happens when we kill too many germs off.
Right. Now, for species that have gone extinct relatively recently, it may be that there are plenty of ecosystems in which it could survive and thrive. So something that died out, you know, 10 years ago or 50 years ago might still have a place to survive and be relatively fine. But for things that went extinct much longer ago, the question is, well, has the world changed so much that this creature would have a real hard time to survive? And is it fair to bring something back to life if it's just going to die out again?
Right. And I think that question is crucial, because even if we're just talking about species that were driven to extinction by humans and not by natural forces, this is not just like hunters going out and killing all of them. A lot of what we're talking about, in fact, I don't know for sure, but I would guess that most of it is due to habitat destruction.
Sure. But the you know, people building cities and going further and further into the surrounding environments mm-hmm. to cut down trees, make pasture land, all that kind of stuff.
Food sources or breeding grounds or anything like that slowly disappearing.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the easiest ways to kill an animal is not to go out looking for all of them and kill them for their tusks or whatever it
Although
is you want.
Although that's much more action-packed.
Well, yeah, it's to destroy their habitat.
Yeah.
If they don't have a place to live and thrive and occupy, there's no chance for them.
One more argument that I've heard against de-extinction is based a lot on the fact that we just don't know very much about what will happen should this technology prove to be useful, to actually work. And that is that species may be able to spread or cause disease or otherwise harm an ecosystem. So it may be that a species that was extinct, when it comes back, becomes a carrier for a disease and then spreads it much more quickly than it would have if that species had never been brought back. That's one. It's really an argument from the unknown, right? We just don't know. This is a plausible outcome, but we don't know if it's or at least a possible outcome. We don't know how plausible it is. And also just to worry about how it would end up affecting the ecosystem you introduce it to. Assuming that you're not just bringing species back to put them in zoos, then putting them into any kind of ecosystem is going to affect that ecosystem.
Oh, sure. And even bits of stuff from other ecosystems that currently exist on the planet can be very detrimental. I mean, look at a kudzu or the little zebra mussels of the Great Lakes or...
Rats everywhere. Or dogs and cats in, say, Australia and New Zealand, which ended up wiping out a lot of both the other predators and prey in that region. So, yeah, I mean, we've seen how bringing a foreign species into an ecosystem can wreak havoc among the rest of the life forms that are there. And for these extinct animals, especially some of them, you could consider them, you know, an alien species to that ecosystem, depending upon how long they've been gone.
Well, probably alien more so than any foreign species currently on Earth, right?
Well, yeah, arguably. I mean, depending, I guess it really depends. We got some really crazy life forms in some very specific ecosystems, and to take them out and put them into something else would definitely be unethical. Don't do that. So one other thing I wanted to touch on before we conclude is other ways this technology could be used. And I had mentioned that there is the possibility that they could use this technology to help in conservation efforts. In other words, specifically helping out endangered species rather than necessarily trying to bring back an extinct one to try and create more biodiversity in existing small populations. So for some species, we're talking, you know, there's some animals out there where the only known members of that population, it adds up to maybe a couple of dozen or maybe even fewer than that.
Well, that's not going to be healthy if their gene pool is that small.
Exactly. You start to really worry about the biodiversity in that population. They can become more prone to birth defects and illnesses. So if you're able to increase that biodiversity, perhaps through using similar methods from the ones we were talking about earlier, but instead of trying to create a new species, you're trying to create new babies in that population, but from diverse samples of DNA, perhaps gathered from, you know, either zoos or in the case of animals that are no longer, you know, that are endangered in the wild, but we still have a zoo population somewhere. Or animals from, you know, material from museums, things like that, to help increase biodiversity and thus make the populations more hardy.
In addition to giving them more genetic diversity, I wonder if genetic engineering could come in to help an animal species that has been endangered by a specific threat. Say, like, if you have a fish that is at great risk because of one specific chemical pollutant in its water supply, could you introduce into the genome of that fish a gene that makes it more resistant to that pollutant?
Yeah, getting into genetic engineering here, and that certainly has its own huge list of controversial elements to it.
As we talked about in our food GMO episodes.
Yeah, right. And GMO, genetically modified organism, it doesn't necessarily have to just refer to plants. It can talk. We can talk about animals as well.
Sure.
I mean, in theory, or at least, you know, you could hypothesize that such a thing is possible. I don't know how long it would take. You know, talking about such a specific application, it's a little tricky Because, I mean, one thing, it would give you a lot of focus in whatever it was you were trying to attempt. But the worry would be that whenever you got to a point where you could address the problem would either have changed or the population would be dead anyway. So,
but it's an interesting idea and an interesting application of the technology, and maybe a little bit more practical than trying to bring back velociraptors.
Well, definitely. Who wants those? They're terrible.
Possibly.
They're so smart.
They're awful at parties.
But on the other hand, if you were going to try to do something like that, then again, you're tampering and introducing this unknown factor, right? Like we talked about with other options earlier, you're changing an organism, which is kind of like introducing an alien organism to an ecosystem. You don't know exactly how that new organism with its different genetic profile is going to function in that ecosystem. What if by giving this fish a gene to make it resistant to this pollutant, suddenly it takes over and now it's an invasive species?
The super fish might turn out to be way more detrimental than
what would have happened if you had just let it alone. This kind of brings us to the final point, which is this idea that you could create whole new species in a way that's kind of what would be happening with the passenger pigeon, right?
Whole new, so not just like a pollutant-resistant fish, but maybe like a fish with eight eyes and a human arm.
Yeah, or a machine gun, you know.
Okay.
It has the equivalent of
talking Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, I'm talking Dr. Moreau in a way. I mean, even more than Dr. Moreau, which was kind of like the chimera approach where he was combining various animals and making them anthropomorphized and all this kind of stuff.
Jonathan, can you do the voice? Just do the voice.
Want me to do Marlon Brando as Dr. Monroe? That Monroe would be the one from The Simpsons.
Right.
No, I cannot do that. You got me tempted, but I'm not going to, because I can't remember the line anymore.
Uh-huh. It's
Val Kilmer doing. I do a terrible impersonation of Val Kilmer doing a terrible impersonation of Marlon Brando doing Dr. Moreau. So that's the way that chain goes. But at any rate, the idea is here that, you know, if you could construct a workable genome for an animal that has never existed, which in a way is kind of what some of these people are doing. You know, they're combining a genome for one species with genomes from very closely related species in an effort to try and revive extinct, like the extinct passenger pigeon. That's specifically the example. But if you take this idea and you extend it into the future and you think, well, what about once we figure out how to actually build those genomes, what stops us from eventually designing a genome for a species that never existed? It's not that it's something that went extinct and we got some of its DNA back and we filled in the gaps with other DNA. This is DNA we have completely built from the ground up.
Like retro-engineering a velociraptor.
Yeah. Essentially, that would be the idea, is that you could, in theory, if assuming that all of this would work. I mean, these are big assumptions. This is really talking like crazy, like singularity level future idea.
Sure.
But yes, you could do that. You could say, well, now we can build ourselves a dinosaur. We can't resurrect the dinosaurs from their DNA.
But we can make a chicken really big and extra mean.
Pretty much.
Wasn't that even a plot point in the novel Jurassic Park? Like the dinosaurs they were making weren't exactly dinosaurs.
Right.
They were making these things that were what
that
people
thought
wanted to see when they came to see a dinosaur.
And that they specifically changed them around a little bit to make them more tourist happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, although they did have several of the behaviors that confirmed the one paleontologist's theories, like the fact that they would migrate.
Yeah.
You know, that was very important in the book toward the very end, as I recall. But anyway, so that's kind of an interesting idea. We don't know that it will ever happen. For one thing, I mean, we still are waiting for the real success story of bringing a species back from extinction. Personally, I hope that it does happen. I would love to see some extinct species come back. I would really love to see this technology being dedicated to help in conservation efforts, obviously. I would really, really love to see human beings behave in a responsible manner to the species around them and not kill them off through destroying their habitats or otherwise. That would be lovely.
Shut up, hippie.
I know.
You don't like panda steaks? Get off this podcast.
Pandas can go. I mean, they can go. They had their time. But no, I'm just kidding, guys.
Create more pandas so that we can all eat panda steaks.
I, as y'all know, I love all the critters of the forest, and I only joke.
Yes, yes. We are making some light of what is otherwise a pretty heavy situation here. But anyway, we will make sure to share a lot of the articles that we read in preparation for this episode, because a lot of them go into great detail and give a really full examination of the story. Some of them are more like profile pieces, but a lot of them really kind of dive into it, make sure that that you can tell the reporter went through the trouble of interviewing various experts with differing points of view to kind of get the full story. So we'll definitely share those in the future. And this was a fun topic to consider, because I mean, just throwing it out there, I know this is kind of similar to the question I had about if you could have any sort of robot animal, what would it be? If you could bring back any extinct species, what would it be?
Beholder.
No, actual species, not constructing a new species. I mean, a real species that once lived on the Earth and now is no more.
I you didn't prepare me for this. I can't think of what it would be. Dodo?
No, Dodo's good. That was my choice for robot animal. I like Dodo's coming back.
I'm really curious about actually horticulture, the way that it existed a few hundred or a few thousand years ago. Like, I want to taste the strawberries that Queen Victoria had in her childhood.
Yeah, or have a decent banana, since all the really good species have pretty much died out.
Oh, I'm raising my hand. Megalodon.
Oh, a megalodon. You want an enormous shark.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Because that way we can have an even better version of Jaws.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Megalodon. Right. Oh, no, there are plenty of megalodon movies already.
I'm aware of them. I know someone who produced one.
Well, but we need a documentary. I mean, a real documentary.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine? Megalodon Week.
I'm in.
Actually, we can make it Megalodon Month. We watch Megalodon movies, so we can tell you about the future of Megalodons.
Now, since you didn't ask, but I'm going to tell you anyway, I'm going to choose Woolly Mammoth. I know it's the popular choice everyone talks about, but it's...
They're so furry.
I mean, it would just be... I can't imagine the intellectual and emotional experience I would undergo witnessing a woolly mammoth walking around.
I can't imagine a better way to feed a megalodon
than a woolly mammoth.
Right.
just dangle a giant woolly mammoth over the megalodons.
Megalodons aren't going to want to eat modern animals. They're going to want to eat woolly mammoths.
It wants to hunt. All right. So we're going to wrap this up on that cheerful note. So guys, if you have any suggestions for our discussions, maybe you want to join in, maybe there's something about this particular topic you would like to contribute to, well, let us know. We have an email address you can send us mail. It is fwthinking@discovery.com, or you can make contact with us on the various social networks that we often can be found on. Those include Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, with the handle FWThinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.